From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the missing Nigerian schoolgirls, getting rid of Syria's chemical weapons, more Russian sanctions possible over Ukraine involvement, plus a coup declared in Thailand. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The United Nations Security Council has imposed sanctions against Nigerian Islamist group Boko Haram, which has carried out a wave of recent deadly attacks, and also the abductions of nearly 300 schoolgirls in Nigeria. Nigeria had asked the committee to add the militant group to the list of al-Qaeda-linked entities that are subject to asset freezes, as well as travel bans and an arms embargo. Also Thursday, teachers across Nigeria took to the streets in a one-day strike to protest Boko Haram's kidnapping of the schoolgirls who've been missing for more than a month now. Abba Musa is an official with the Nigerian Union of Teachers.
Are on the street today because they need to be on the streets because of the pending problem that has besetting the Nigerian society, in particular reference between the three states in the sub-region. One, our girls has been adopted by the so-called Boko Haram's people, and since then, because of the inability of the federal government to have a look, if any or otherwise, for the release of these girls, that's why the National Head Office of the Nigerian Union of Teachers organized these rallies all over the country so that the people will participate and show our concern towards the release of our girls that have been adopted in Chibok local government.
Several countries have pledged support for Nigeria in its effort to find the girls, including the U.S. On Thursday, members of the U.S. Air Force began work in Chad, flying a drone aircraft to aid in the search for the schoolgirls. VOA's Jeff Seldon has more from U.S. Defense Headquarters at the Pentagon.
The unmanned, unarmed Predator drone now flying from Chad joins the larger, longer-range Global Hawk and a manned, specially equipped twin-engine turboprop plane in the skies over Nigeria as the U.S. expands its search for the missing girls.
This is now, it's an air operation. It's using a mix of manned and unmanned assets as the situation dictates.
Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says U.S. forces are flying multiple missions at a time, looking for any trace of the schoolgirls kidnapped last month by the militant Islamic group Boko Haram. But he says the search remains difficult.
It's a very large area of terrain. It's rugged terrain. It is densely wooded, jungle. So it's a difficult search. This is a hard search.
For now, U.S. surveillance efforts are focused on Nigeria's interior, including the northeastern part of the country, where officials suspect the girls were taken after possibly being split up. And while none of the U.S. planes or drones are armed, all of them carry a variety of sensors and imaging technology that officials hope will find some trace of the girls. So far, though, officials here say they've found nothing. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Presidents of Cameroon and Chad met Thursday to map out ways to combat Boko Haram, which has extended its violence from Nigeria to its neighbors. Presidents Paul Biya and Idris Deby also examined security reports that some weapons used by Boko Haram came from Libya through Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzika reporting now from Yaoundé.
The two leaders said they were meeting to fine-tune plans and reiterate the commitments they made in Paris on May 17 to wage war against Boko Haram. Colonel Didier Bajek, spokesperson for Cameroon's military, told VOA that the two governments were committed more than ever to fight Boko Haram alongside Nigerian forces.
Nous ne pouvons rester sourds face aux inquiétudes de nos frères et sœurs qui ont peur devant les actes abjects.
We cannot be indifferent when our brothers and sisters live in permanent fear from those who have taken upon themselves to use violence on everyone instead of a spiritual rearmament they claim to bring, he says. Nyambele Elvis, a Chadian expert on security issues, told VOA that the presidents of Chad and Cameroon had agreed to allow their forces to cross into the territories of each country in pursuit of terrorist and armed groups.
Il y a des accords qui permettent aux forces de sécurité des deux pays de pouvoir poursuivre des malfaiteurs.
He says there are accords that authorize security forces from the two countries to pursue havoc wreckers up to 30 kilometers from the border. He adds it was therefore necessary to reinforce that measure and increase mixed patrols in the border area. Nyambele Elvis cites intelligence reports that Boko Haram has received sophisticated weapons from the Middle East and the Maghreb through Sudan and Chad to Nigeria and Cameroon. He said weapons also came in from Libya and that training of Boko Haram members took place in Mali when Islamist militants controlled the north of that country. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Russia and China vetoed a UN Security Council resolution Thursday that would have referred an investigation of human rights abuses in Syria to the International Criminal Court at The Hague. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the UN in New York.
The draft resolution received 13 votes in favor, but the effort to seek accountability for mass murders, rapes, torture, and other grave crimes committed by all parties to the conflict failed because Russia and China exercised their right of veto. It is the fourth time since the conflict began in March 2011 that the two council members have blocked action on Syria. Without the council's authorization, the case of Syria will not be referred to the ICC. Cases can only go to the court if the council refers them, or if the country in question is a party to the treaty that created the court. Syria is not a party. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Syria has destroyed the vast majority of its chemical weapons arsenal as mandated by an international agreement. VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshna takes a look now at the process of destroying Syria's chemical weapons.
The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, says Syria has removed from its territory, or destroyed in country, more than 92% of its declared stockpile of chemical weapons. Greg Thielman, an expert on weapons of mass destruction with the Arms Control Association, says Syria's chemical weapons stockpile was substantial.
The total stockpile was something like 1,300 metric tons, which would make it one of the largest existing operational chemical weapons stockpiles in the world. North Korea would be the only other competitor for that. That having been said, one should also remember that the U.S. and the Soviet Union had such huge chemical weapons stockpiles that even after many years of working on the destruction, the U.S. and Russia still have a lot of chemical weapons to destroy, but none of those stockpiles are operational in any way.
Syria's chemical weapons arsenal included mustard gas, the more modern sarin, and even VX, the most toxic of all chemicals. Last September, Syria agreed to dispose of its chemical weapons after pressure from Russia and the threat of military action from the United States. Syria agreed to destroy all of its chemical weapons by June 30th. Joe Cirincione is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation.
The first part of this destruction process went very smoothly. That is, the chemicals were consolidated in about a dozen sites and secured. Remember, there's a civil war going on here, so there's always concern that something could happen to these chemical weapons. The actual destruction began around October, beginning of October 2013, where you started to destroy some of the precursor chemicals in site.
Precursors are chemicals that can be mixed together to create a chemical weapons agent. Thielman says most of the agents to be destroyed are in large containers, which are then moved to a port in Syria and loaded onto cargo ships.
It's an American ship that is involved in destroying them. There are ships of other countries, though, that are transporting the bulk agent from the Syrian port to the American ship, which would be anchored off the coast of Italy, and the transfer would occur there. It's been quite an elaborate process of not only having other countries involved in taking the agent away from Syria, but also other countries have provided warships as escorts to make sure that nothing happens to the chemicals on their way to this U.S. ship.
Experts say while more than 90% of Syria's chemical weapons has either been destroyed or moved from the country, there are signs that Damascus is hesitant to relinquish the last 8%. Joe Serencioni says the Syrians have mentioned they are concerned about security on the roads between the port and the sites where chemicals are stored.
But we also suspect that it's tied to Syria's demand that it be able to keep in place a network of tunnels and buildings that were used to store chemical weapons previously. Under the terms of the agreement, these tunnels, these facilities are to be completely destroyed. Syria would like to repurpose them to hold them on for other purposes. That dispute is unresolved.
Another potential dispute centers around allegations that the Syrian government has used chlorine gas over the past few months against civilians and rebel forces in different parts of the country. Damascus denies those charges. The allegations are being investigated by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Andre Deneshner of VOA News, Washington.
Friction is rising between U.S. lawmakers and the Obama administration over the ground rules for America's global anti-terror efforts, nearly 13 years after the so-called 9/11 attacks on September 11th of 2001. VOA's Michael Bowman reports now the issue is central to matters ranging from U.S. drone strikes to CIA activities to America's future military engagement in Afghanistan to detainees held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Weeks after the 9/11 attacks, Congress authorized an open-ended military campaign against al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorist groups. That authorization to use military force, or AUMF, was the focus of a speech by President Barack Obama last year.
Not every collection of thugs that labels themselves al-Qaeda will pose a credible threat to the United States. Unless we discipline our thinking, our definitions, our actions, we may be drawn into more wars we don't need to fight. So I look forward to engaging Congress and the American people in efforts to refine and ultimately repeal the AUMF's mandate. And I will not sign laws designed to expand this mandate further.
A year later, the AUMF remains in place and the rules for drone strikes remain a matter of administration policy, not codified law. Mr. Obama appears no closer to fulfilling his pledge to close the Guantanamo Bay facility, although Congress has restricted closing the military prison. At a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, Chairman Robert Menendez posed this question to administration legal advisers.
Is the 9/11 AUMF broken in some way? Is it obsolete? Is it inadequate to the threats we and our friends and allies face today and for the foreseeable future?
The Pentagon's lead attorney, Stephen Preston, declined to pass judgment on the existing AUMF and spoke in general terms of what is needed going forward.
The challenge is to ensure that the authorities for U.S. military operations are both adequate and appropriately tailored to the threat.
Such vagueness tested the patience of senators of both parties. The panel's top Republican, Bob Corker, addressed Preston.
Are there groups that we cannot go against today, yes or no?
The president has invited us to focus and engage in dialogue with Congress about the continued necessity and utility of the AUMF or a follow-on legal regime.
And you're really frustrating me.
There are.
And I have a generally good nature. I have had no reach out from the administration. So that is another line of hollow comments from this administration. You have reached out in no way to talk to us about refining this.
The committee also sought input from past U.S. officials. Former State Department legal advisor Harold Koh argued against a permanent military authorization.
We shouldn't treat the AUMF as a perpetual, all-purpose security blanket that can be distorted and that will itself become a distorting force. We can, in time, repeal the AUMF and rely on other authorities to fill these gaps. And not to do so from that point, I think, would be bad for our counterterrorism policy and bad for our Constitution.
Michael Mukasey, who served as Attorney General during the George W. Bush administration, said a legalistic argument over the use of military force misses a larger point.
There are people who are committed to destroy Western civilization, and we are the principal focus of their energies. We could declare tomorrow that the war was over. We could repeal the AOMF, and that would not change their agenda. They get a vote in this.
The Obama administration insists it has been far from passive on the appropriate use of military force. It notes efforts made to prevent civilian casualties in drone strikes and its notification of appropriate congressional committees every time a strike is ordered. U.S. officials say they will be in a better position to decide the future role of force against terrorism once the fate of a pending security agreement with Afghanistan is known. Such assurances do not seem to satisfy U.S. lawmakers. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
This with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Ukraine's acting Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said Thursday that Russia was bluffing by saying it would pull back its troops from the Ukrainian border. Mr. Yatsenyuk also said Russia attempts to seize Ukrainian territory had been unsuccessful.
Вважаю, що заяви Російської Федерації про відведення військ від українських.
He said a fourth attempt at breaking the border was made at night from the side of the Russian Federation. From that, the Russian side, three trucks escorted, he said, by one car, tried to break a state border. While fighting raged on in Ukraine, Russia's defense ministry said on Thursday its armed forces were leaving the regions near Ukraine as part of a massive military pullout ordered by President Vladimir Putin prior to Ukraine's presidential election set for Sunday. Western nations are warning Russia that they will toughen economic sanctions if Moscow interferes with that election. Economic analysts are divided on what impact sanctions have had so far on Russia's economy and the actions of its leaders. Some say sanctions frighten off investors and hurt the economy. Others say those sanctions have already kept Moscow from pushing harder into Ukraine. And still others are skeptical that sanctions will not have much impact. VOA's Jim Randall reports.
Pro-Russian activists have been working to take over parts of eastern Ukraine using tactics similar to those that helped Moscow annex Crimea. Western nations are already using sanctions to punish Russia for seizing Crimea and to discourage any possible Russian invasion of other parts of Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says economic sanctions could get much tougher.
If Russia or its proxies disrupt the election, the United States and those countries represented here today in the European Union will impose sectoral economic sanctions.
Russia's vital oil and natural gas industry could be one target of stronger sanctions. That would be a big change from sanctions that so far have been aimed just at people in Russian President Vladimir Putin's inner circle. John Chambers of the Standard & Poor's Financial Services Company says sanctions worry investors because they increase uncertainty.
But there's already been an impact on the Russian economy. You see that in the financial markets, and you see that in outward portfolio flows.
Uncertainty makes it hard for investors to assess risk, prompting them to take money out of the country. Without capital to buy and build things, the economy can stall or even shrink. Russia's economy already had problems, making it hard to judge the impact of sanctions, according to Columbia University professor Tim Fry, who spoke via Skype.
There's lots of negative underlying trends in the Russian economy that have dramatically slowed growth in the last couple of years. at the margins, sanctions may be increasing some economic uncertainty, but they're not having a broad economic impact yet.
An economist who once advised the Russian and Ukrainian governments says sanctions could get stronger. Anders Aslund of the Peterson Institute for International Economics says sanctions may have kept Moscow from taking stronger military action against Ukraine.
It's not obvious, but I think that we have worked. What we are seeing is that the Russian action in eastern Ukraine looks as if it's faltering. And one of the factors behind it is sanctions.
Aslund says Russia's economy will shrink rather than grow this year, at least in part due to sanctions. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
The United States has voiced disappointment with the military takeover of Thailand's government, saying there is no justification for the coup. In a statement on Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry voiced concerns about reports that senior Thai political leaders have been detained by the military, called for their immediate release and a return to democracy. Mr. Kerry also warned the takeover will have negative implications for U.S. relations with the Thai military. Secretary Kerry's spokesperson Jennifer Psaki explains what comes next.
We are reviewing our military and other assistance to the government of Thailand. We've taken preliminary steps to suspend military engagement and assistance while we consider the facts on the ground. This is a standard part of the process that would take place. So right now there's a comprehensive review of that going on.
Psaki spoke hours after Thai General Prayuth Chan-o-cha announced the coup in a televised statement and 2 days after declaring martial law. He said the move suspending the Constitution was aimed at restoring order, pushing through political reform. The general also ordered the country's acting prime minister and cabinet to report to the army. Heavy security was visible on the streets of Urumqi in China's Xinjiang province on Thursday after two SUVs rammed their way through shoppers while setting off explosives. 31 people were killed, 90 others injured. The attack was the bloodiest so far in a series of violent incidents over recent months. The Chinese authorities have blamed on radical separatists from the country's Muslim Uyghur minority. Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei said this violent incident again lays bare the anti-human, anti-social, and anti-civilization nature of the terrorist. He says it deserves the condemnation of both the internal community, international community, and the Chinese people. It was not immediately clear who was responsible for the attack.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Paul McCartney's spokesman says the former Beatle is on the mend after being treated in a Tokyo hospital for a virus. Thursday's statement from publicist Stuart Bell says McCartney will make a complete recovery and has been ordered to take a few days' rest. 71-year-old singer-songwriter has postponed planned performances in Tokyo and Seoul since falling ill last week. His world tour is scheduled to resume next month here in the U.S. British Virgin Islands setting up a sanctuary for all shark species in its territorial waters. Country's leadership says the islands recognize that sharks are critical to oceans and reefs. Across the globe, an estimated 100 million sharks are killed each year in commercial fisheries. Because of their long lifespans and low fertility rates, sharks are highly vulnerable to overfishing. Pew Charitable Trust says the British Virgin Islands joins Honduras and the Bahamas as the first governments in the Americas to declare shark sanctuaries. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Sidrak Franklin, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On April 23, 1616, William Shakespeare died at the age of 52. Shakespeare is considered by many to have been the greatest writer in the English language. On this date in 1778, American Revolutionary War hero John Paul Jones, along with volunteers from his warship Ranger, landed at Whitehaven, England, setting one ship afire. It would be the only American raid on English soil during the U.S. War for Independence. In 1858, German physicist Max Planck was born. Planck developed the quantum theory that provides an explanation for the movement of particles within atoms. In 1928, American child actress and future ambassador Shirley Temple was born. Temple starred in more than 40 movies. She served four presidents in several diplomatic posts, including ambassador to Ghana, Czechoslovakia, and the United Nations. In 1940, more than 200 people died in the Rhythm nightclub fire in Natchez, Mississippi. In 1942, Germany launched the first in a series of raids on English cities following British air attacks on the ancient German city of Lübeck during World War II. The so-called Baedeker raids killed more than 1,600 people and injured hundreds more. In 1949, the Chinese Red Army conquered the city of Nanjing during the Communist Revolution. That victory ended the Republic of China's rule on the mainland. On this day in 1975, in a speech at Tulane University, President Gerald Ford acknowledged the end of America's involvement in Vietnam. A week later, North Vietnamese forces captured Saigon, unifying the country under communist rule. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Representatives from 11 Arab and Western countries, known as the London 11 Core Group of the Friends of Syria, met recently in London. The group, which supports the moderate Syrian opposition, issued a communique announcing that through a coordinated strategy, it would take steps to increase its support of the Syrian opposition coalition, the Supreme Military Council, and associated moderate armed groups. The group also denounced the Assad regime's unilateral plan to hold illegitimate presidential elections on June 3rd. At a press briefing after the meeting, Secretary of State John Kerry said that to help the moderate opposition in Syria, every facet of what can be done is going to be ramped up, every facet, and that includes political effort. It includes the aid to the opposition. It includes economic efforts, sanctions.
There will be ramped up effort to make it clear that despite the fact that Assad may think today he's doing better and this process is somehow going to come to a close with him sitting pretty, the answer is no. You know, we're not going away. The opposition is not going away. We are determined to reach a political settlement that protects all of the people of Syria.
Mr. Kerry noted that the United States has been frustrated with the current process of trying to get humanitarian aid to Syrians in desperate need, and that the Friends of Syria group is working to find new avenues to reach the people, some of whom have been under siege by Assad's forces and were being starved to death. To make sure aid is delivered, Mr. Kerry said, "We're going to join with other countries in an effort to try to guarantee accountability through the UN." Mr. Kerry called Assad's plan for a presidential election in the midst of the violence and the chaos he has unleashed in the country a farce, and noted that the Friends of Syria group has spoken in a strong and unified voice about the lack of legitimacy of such an election. How do you have a legitimate election when half the people in your country are displaced and not able to vote? Asked Mr. Kerry. How do you have a legitimate election when another several million people are in refugee camps unable to vote? Secretary of State Kerry said, Assad's staged elections are an insult. They are a fraud on democracy, on the Syrian people, and on the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.